afternoon, and I wish you all a very warm and fruitful Columbus Day, and also a Yom Kippur for those of you who are celebrating. I guess if you're celebrating and not here, I guess celebrating is probably the wrong word. We're very lucky today to have two guests with us to help us get going on this cardboard case study that we want to do. And our panelists have also prepared some stuff on Echelon, which I don't know if it is today, but makes it quite interesting. Also, let me just take a quick straw poll. How many people here are hoping to do a third-year paper or a 25-page LLM paper in conjunction with this course? Raise your hands if so. Okay, somehow many of you can scare off. And those who are planning to do it, I hope you know you should be cutting in something for me very soon to indicate your interest in this set. Alright, so we have with us today an attorney with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Greg Mott, over there. We have high-tech microphones, so we're going to press the button if you want to talk and then we'll go to the monitor. We also have Simpson Gartner with us, author of the book Database Station, former fellow of the Berkman Center. And in case he's still a fellow, you see on the classroom today. And somebody who is quite up on information privacy issues and a gearhead in his own right, having one of his own internet service provider. I'm going to sit here if you're not that. And Greg, maybe you can give us just a bit more of a self introduction, sort of what you do with the Bureau and how you came to be doing
it. My name is Greg Lotta, and I'm an assistant general counsel for the FBI headquarters. I'm in the technology law unit, which is charged with the duty of really assisting the Bureau in implementing new technology into its primary core mission of criminal investigations. We focus in three primary areas: CLIA, the Communication Systems for Law Enforcement Act, telecommunications mergers, related to section 214, 310 of the SEC statute, which really charges the SEC considering the public interest and public safety before approving a transfer of licenses in an international merger. And then lastly, with the implementation of technology in the laboratory industry. My focus is in the laboratory industry. I was previously the chief of the computer crimes division here at the Attorney General's office in Boston. Prior to that, I did stint at the War Crimes Tribunal, and prior to that, I was head of narcotics enforcement in the state of Maine.
And we're also aware that this is his day off. He's very generously decided to spend it with us. So thank you very much. So just to get us started, before we even start taking up carnivore as a case study, maybe you can just give us a brief bit of background about electronic surveillance. And I think it would be safe to say you could pretend that we know nothing, and we will not disappoint you. So fill us in a little bit on how much goes on and what are the meat and potatoes. When we talk electronic surveillance, what are we talking
about? I would say day to day, the bulk of electronic surveillance is one party, consensual monitoring, that is either an agent acting undercover or a confidential informant or cooperating witness who's wearing body wire under a theory that they're part of communication and able to be recorded. Just as a footnote, the procedure for that requires a prosecutor's approval. Unlike the state level, most prosecutors' offices have no input whatsoever with it. When the detectives record a consensual encounter, and that's true here in Massachusetts, that's true in Maine. I'm also an infiltrator. In New Hampshire, they have a statute that requires a prosecutor's approval. But other than that, for the most part, the United States, at the 50 state level, that monitoring is done without any kind of oversight other than the police themselves. The rest of the electronic surveillance that we tends to be on telephones, principally in emergency cases. Most notably, we start with what's referred to as a pen register and track and trace, and the highly keen section 3121 C. speak. And these are old terms, actually, just in a nutshell. Head register, people always feel like it's the rotary telephone, unless you're from Maine. But they still use the rotary telephone. Right? My former hometown is there, so that's party line, the rotary telephone. But rotary telephone system ran on a circuit interruption system. When you dial, dial the number, that mechanism would open and break the circuit a number of times. And even as a small child, you try to block on the phone, keep my sister from using these long distance calls. We learned you could click the receiver several times and dial the number anyway, just to get the right sequence down. Well, pen register is literally for the flip side of that, a magneto pen, almost on a continuous strip of paper. And every time the circuit was opened and closed, the pen would come down and hit dot. And the paper would move forward, and you would read it like a ticket tape. If there were 9 dots, then the number 9 would dial into the 8 dots. So the term is still used in statute today, pen and register. A traffic trace was slightly more involved, but it basically recorded the number. It was the ancient equivalent of caller ID, that is who is calling into a circuit, what number is dialing into the circuit. And that presupposed that the number was coming from within the same system. Pen register, traffic trace under Slippers, Maryland, the ruling from the Supreme Court was it was not an expectation of privacy in the number dialed because as much as an order, business order, you're putting into the company. And indeed, in the earlier days, up until 5 years ago in Bryant Pond, Maine, you had to ask a person, you know, Teresa, my particular operator, would you give me John Smith at 95551? And so, obviously, except you communicate that to another person, then there would hardly be an expectation of privacy. So the theory behind it was that except you dialed numbers, they weren't really content. They were kind of a work order shared with the corporation. Therefore, there was diminished expectation of privacy. Congress came along and enacted the pen register statute, which set a very low threshold, admittedly, for the issuance of pen registers. The prosecutor, in order to get a pen register to record a target's number dialed, the prosecutor would have to certify that the evidence likely to be obtained from a pen register would be relevant with an ongoing criminal investigation. The court, under the way the statute is currently worded, does not have discretion to examine the prosecutor about that. But if you read the legislative history of 3121, it was really designed more to keep a check on the number of pen registers that were being put in place, because really they were just, what was unique about them was they were real-time billing records, but they were nonetheless, kind of in a sense, business records, phone companies being acquired in real-time. In some states, and for a time, my own experience in Maine, there was local management service, which every number you dial was recorded. Prosecutors didn't bother with pen registers. They just waited at the end of the month, or waited at the end of the week, and they got all the numbers dialed. So that kind of illustrates the point. So the bulk, I would say, would be telephone calls and pen registers. Then last, the third category would be Title III, or T3, full content intercepts. And in this scenario, just very briefly, the scenario that would happen would be the agents would require what they believe to be probable cause. They would have to write it down, draft affidavit, delineating the basis of their knowledge, and so forth and so on. That would go to the principal legal advisor inside the field office, who was an attorney assigned to the field office. It would be reviewed there. If it was approved, or it would be changed. If it was approved, it would go from there to the Office of General Counsel, our office. The technology law unit, we would review it and consider make recommend changes. If it was approved there, we'd then go to the prosecutor's office, the assistant United States attorney for that district. They would review it, and if it was approved there, we'd then go to the deputy general counsel's office in Washington, D.C. It would be reviewed typically first by law clerks and then by a senior staff attorney. Then it would go to the usually the deputy attorney general himself, for signature under authorization, or in unique cases, to the attorney general.
This is to do a full content intercept of telephone calls to a given person under investigation.
That's right. The affidavit would have to demonstrate first probable cause, obviously. Mm-hmm. Second, you have to identify the facility for which the calls would be intercepted. And lastly, we have to demonstrate that traditional investigative means, like for instance a one-party consensual monitoring, have been tried and failed, or otherwise with a reasonable likelihood would prove unsuccessful. Assuming all those standards were met, to pass those levels, we'd then go to a federal judge. I guess I left that on clerk for a time. A federal judge usually would have his law clerk scour through it, unless he felt fairly comfortable, and then he would review it and sign it or not. The procedure, once it is signed, is that you have, typically they're drafted such a way, usually we'll have about 10 days to implement them. You have to phone company, it doesn't agree on isolate the switch, run a parallel line to a secure location where you can set up the actual monitoring equipment. And you have to do periodic reports, typically in the base data, I think it's usually every 10 days. You report to the judge the number of calls that were intercepted, the number that were criminal, the number that were not criminal, that were minimized, that is, where you cut off the phone call after a few minutes.
And by cut off the phone call, you don't mean literally cut off the call to the people, you just stop listening, right, realizing that they're ordering a pizza and it's not relevant.
That's right. If you're talking to John Smith and he's calling from the dormitory, obviously, you can isolate the phone even if it's his phone, but invariably, because we have people using the line, the agents are authorized. Each judge tends to alter the minimization order a little bit. Typically, the agents will authorize the authors of the 2 or 3 minutes to listen to the person's attorney, making a judgment right there and then whether or not there's something inculpatory. So they have a free zone of a minute or two, I guess, to make an evaluation. After that minute or two period, they're really committed. They continue to intercept. They will have to justify that it was relatively authorized criminal investigation was needed to the federal court. Then lastly, when all said and done, in the case of seeking prosecution, it depends again on the state statute and the federal statute, but invariably, every single person whose phone call was intercepted will receive notice of the intercept, assuming that they can get identified.
Now, just to iron this part out, we said switching station is somewhere typically not far from wherever the actual physical phone is located. It might be on hold in your house, it might be in the university, in some room on the science center, but it's pretty much approximate. Is that any different from digital phone numbers?
It is different. typically, you have to be.
If you're going to say something,
that's just not true. The switching station is a central office. It's not on the pole top. It's on the phone company brick building.
So you think it would be something
like on Ware Street? Well, like on Ware Street, there's a switching station. Now, at Harvard University, you have your own telephone switch. So if the FBI had an order to wiretap the president of Harvard University, they would have to enlist the aid of the people here. They would set up the tap either at the CO, at your ESS, or at another secure location. Head off from it. I think it's called a trap and trace.
I'm sorry, what is it?
Is it called trap and trace? Or
trap and trace.
T-R-A-P, right? The note said T-R-A-C-K. And I know this because I used to have one of these on my phone line back when I was an undergraduate at MIT. The MIT police put it because I was getting death threats and we were trying to find the source of it.
So
do
you ever mail it down?
Yeah,
we did.
you can actually buy these radio sets. There's a little printer system that both print register and of course track trace today is just caller ID. It's digital one. It's good stuff to do.
And you know, just a round number, typically how many of these happen the course of a year in the office?
The pen registers. I don't actually study the industry. Like 324 half of the federal government per se, but there was another couple hundred of half the states.
Maybe more than that. The under the 1968 Omnibus Crime and Control Act, the federal and state authorities that do wiretaps are required to do a report to the administrative courts of the United States. The administrative courts produce an annual report called the Wiretap Report. You used to have to go to the library to get it, now you can download it off the internet. There's actually, and it will detail for you how many wiretaps of each type are done each year, and also for what purpose the wiretaps were done. The The overwhelming number of wiretaps are done for drugs, more than 40-50% at this point. During the Clinton administration, the number of wiretaps has almost doubled from 800-900 a year to something like 1,600 a year. But that number is misleading. That's wiretap orders. In one of the cases back in 97, there were 53 different wiretaps in place for a single order, and that was actually in Boston.
By that, you mean like a work phone or a home phone, or you mean multiple times
in
a single phone?
In the case of the Boston case, it was 53 different people who had their phones wiretapped as part of a single wiretap order. That was a very large criminal drug conspiracy. The track and trace orders of pen registers are very useful because they will give you a map of the criminal enterprise. And so when you have one person who you think is involved in the enterprise, you'll put a tap on their line, get a list of everybody they call, everybody who calls them, and then you look at each one of those individuals to see if you have reason to suspect them. And then you put a track and trace on every one of their phones. And so you'll quickly map out all the people involved in the enterprise. Then you can go back and get actual T3s to do the voice intercepts. And one of the things that we've seen looking at the reports that come in is that most criminals say, oh, our phones are being tapped, and they joke about it. And you can hear this on the tapes. And then they go ahead and they give evidence that the criminals
say, most criminals are stupid.
Yeah.
So the velocity of the gains was always if they were right, we would catch them. I think that I agree with what he said, although what the wiretap report says is a little bit misleading also in the sense that it really doesn't delineate between federal task forces and state task forces. No, if the applicant is a federal agent that lists as a federal application, even though the agent would probably refer the detail to the task force, and it wouldn't be a case that result in federal prosecution. So the numbers are going to be difficult, and the classification that were created is really kind of historical, let's say, racketeering versus narcotics. And now some of those may be more useful given the fact that the narcotics statutes, you know, have provisions dealing with conspiracy to commit murder and so on. There could be more meat put into delineating those. But there are a large number, there are clearly thousands with regard to pen register statute. And it's difficult to know truly with regard to pen registers how many are in fact being utilized increasingly, because I know the states emboldened by Lopez, not the decisions are of the opinion that it's not a federal government business, and some of them begin to insist they cannot be compelled to disclose to the federal government their list of targets and under what authority does this exist. So the reporting is an issue. Let me just say, while there are thousands, and it has certainly increased, the increase has resulted in large measure because of two companies, PennLink and another one, which have put out automated equipment with a price range that states would afford. So if you chart, as I understand it, the percentage of growth has really been at the state level for state investigations.
So it's lower the cost of monitoring, more monitoring can take place.
Right. Initially, when it truly was older equipment, and even today, actually, in most states, what will happen is the phone company will go to the switch and they'll make a replication card, which will kind of like create an extension. Then they run a private line to the police department. And you connect the pen register there to the police department. So that, in essence, it doesn't interfere in any way with the phone company's equipment. It's like an off-site extension to the phone company. But that's expensive. You know, in the state of Maine, I know, I think when I was there about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, we were lucky to run maybe 10 a year that we could afford. And that would be serious benefit. I mean, we're talking, you know, pounds of heroin being brought into the state. It's not minor benefit.
When chips rates, has the advent of digital networks affected the expense of monitoring or anything else?
We can get into that. With regards to email, it has not, in fact, introduced it. Simple mail transfer protocols such that most networks can isolate blocks of merely intelligence that are on the network to replicate the email. With regard to web mail, in other types of interfaces, instant messaging and those types of technologies and digital telepathy, the extent that it is actually being used, and not merely interfacing with public plain telephone network systems. Those are actually much less robust. And that's what developed in the advent of cardboard.
Two important things to notice, just to finish up the last thing. The majority of the orders are for drugs or racketeering. But whenever the FBI in public has made a claim for the need for better electronic surveillance, they always say that it's for terrorism and for kidnapping. But those are very, very small percentage of the number of cases that are actually under investigation. I didn't want to try to call it. The second point is that the wiretapping of the email and stuff like that is what we're going to be discussing, but that's not traditionally done with by putting a tap on the line. There was work done on that, trying to record the modem tones and reconstruct the signal. And the FBI found it's much easier to get the assistance of the internet service providers and to get the information while it's still digital.
So I want to explore that for a second. But before we really turn to internet, just to kind of go back on, are there questions on as much as we've covered before we turn to the internet stuff? So, anybody want to ask a question? Yeah, go ahead, Brian.
How often does a federal judge really turn down or strongly vet the application? I just pulled up the report, and it seems over the past 10 years that the application for wiretap has been turned down 3 times.
Yeah, what I'd like to see, and we just discussed this before, this is a point that's frequently made by the Center for Democracy and Technology in Washington, which we spar with originally. What I would say to this report, would you call up the number of cases the appeals courts have reversed? That would be a mortality and significance. I mean, because your indication of your question is that the judge is a rubber stamp. All right? Well, then you have to believe that everybody's rubber stamp, even in the Ninth Circuit, which doesn't rubber stamp any.
I think if we saw rambling,
you would at least have some type of factor to multiply. But there are. And we argue, frankly, as a prosecutor putting aside my current position, most agents do not want to do a Title III. It's very labor intensive, and the process in most cases, unless there's imminent threat of bodily harm, where you can get an emergency Title III, you have to get an order within 48 hours thereafter. But even in those cases, if there's imminent bodily harm, there's a tendency to try to go through the paper route first. But without that, it tends to be a 30-day minimum before it goes through the approval process. The agents are not in favor of Title III because of the time consumption.
But there's a rare exception for exigent circumstances where you just put in the tab and then later clean up the line.
It's seldom used. It requires the protocol for the most part, although she does delegate it, the protocol with this Attorney General is that she will review them personally.
Yeah. I want to ask you a question. Can you address the issue of national security wiretaps, which are not covered under this, and also wiretapping of foreign nationals inside the United States?
Well, first of all, even that's not carte blanche. You still have to go to the spy court in D.C., so-called spy court, the special court for the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. There's a rotating court of judges in the circuit court of appeal that sit on the superior applications. Even in those cases, you still have to demonstrate probable cause that the individual that you want to monitor is acting as a representative of a foreign power.
That's odd. Yeah, not a spy court. Or spy court.
Is representing
a foreign power. Content monitoring of a conversation.
And if he's engaged either in some active criminal activity, no. Again, criminal activity in this context can be relative to the spy statutes themselves, and frequently are. But those orders, and it's hard for us to discuss that. People, the a significant portion, not, I don't know what percentage is frankly, but a significant portion of the Bureau's work continues to be foreign intelligence and foreign espionage prosecution. Sometimes a little less public than other times, but, and so those numbers are not reflected in the overall need for electronic surveillance. But even there, there's an application process, just that they're all kept secret and sealed, and that process it is itself a very time-consuming process. At the Office of the General Counsel, we have a separate unit called the National Security Law Unit, which is sealed in their own little room, where if you talk and you know, your whisper falls before leaving the mouth, because of the noise damage. But,
that's how it works with the students, remember? That's what you're talking about, I guess. Nobody remembers the student fees I was talking about. Thanks,
but, so, it's, in other words, they have very significant responsibility. You know, it's funny, you know, I have to say, I was talking to my colleagues this morning, Dr. Kerr, the assistant director of the laboratory, was originally invited, couldn't make it, sent me, and my colleague said, well, you know, I hope you can wear a black suit, sunglasses, and a FBI lapel today, just so you can live up to the expectations of everyone at Harvard. And I tried that as an example. There's a cartoonist out there in Orange County who did a great cartoon. I tried to have special services blow up in the Federal Express out there. Maybe I'll send it anyway. But it has the FBI agent. He's apparently talking to a group. He's got sunglasses and he's pointing at the big monitor. And the monitor, it says, to myhoney@privacy.com. And the subject line is XXOO, and the body of the message is, "Dearest Love Muffin, I can hardly wait to see you," and the cursor is flashing, so he's typing it. And the agent is pointing up to the CC line, which reads FBI.gov, and the captured desktop says, "The great thing is that software we conveniently install at your internet service provider will type this line for you." We thought that was hilarious. And then someone else actually also made an application for your AOL that set a little mailbox with flags and each entry thing says, "You have some mail."
You have some cups. As an attorney of the internet, part of things, I also want you to get something.
I'm going to touch on part of
the world. Let me use the mic that's behind your monitor.
With the current carnivore software, what's to stop someone, an FBI agent from, you monitor some certain group's activity, the drug conspiracy, and then after that you get, certain terms that you decide just to sniff computers with, I do heroin, something like that.
So let's walk through just how carnivore works. Let's, the segue to that is the point Simpson made, that if you want to eavesdrop on someone engaging in internet-related communications, one way to do it, if they use dialogue, they use a modem, is to just eavesdrop on the phone line as if it's a regular conversation. Instead of voices, you hear data, and then you try to translate that data into something. Simpson says, that's not that easy to do. It's an analog thing you're doing, you're trying to convert the data on the fly. It would be a lot easier to let the modem do its thing, convert it into data at the internet service provider. That's whom you call when you dial up. And at that point, it's just data that starts circling through the internet as if you were directly connected. And if there were some way you could listen in at that juncture, you'd be a lot better off than trying to eavesdrop on the actual phone line or which somebody's using to get into the network. Now, this one preliminary question.
If I can interrupt a second. It's important to understand that when you look at the internet, there are a lot of places where you can wiretap email. One obvious place to do it is where the mailboxes are. You can have the machine that puts the data into the mailbox simply make a copy somewhere else.
And this is among the recipients?
This is on the recipients or the senders. You can do that in a variety of places. And a whole bunch of wiretap, email wiretaps, the FBI has not been done that way, but that requires direct participation from the people running the servers.
So this is just like if you go away for the summer on the Harvard Law School server, you can send open mail to forward copies of your mail to your Hotmail account or something.
Right.
So with the cooperation of the network department, we can just send open mail to forward copies of all your information.
Yeah, yeah. So actually it goes two places.
Right.
Another place is you could just hook into the local area network at the internet service provider, capture all the traffic, and throw away the traffic that you don't want. And that's what Carnivore, we're told, does.
Well, there's nothing we're told, but
I don't know how to break codes,
okay.
And that's what we're told.
And the other place you could do it is actually on the internet backbone and look at all the email in the country.
Well, that was my preliminary question. That's why I had a preliminary question for Carnivore. There is some sense in which we could release a hound, literally release a bunch of drug-sniffing dogs in an airport. And they just kind of wander around, they make nice to people, and occasionally they sniff a suitcase and there are drugs inside, and then it's all over for whoever has a suitcase.
Well, I've actually had that happen to me. When I came into Logan from England last time, they let all the people off the plane into the baggage area, but they didn't let our bags out. And instead, a whole bunch of customs agents came out with dogs. There were like three of them. And they kept saying to the dogs,
three dogs or three customs agents?
Six customs agents, three dogs. And they kept saying to the dogs, find it, find it. And they actually sniffed down everybody there looking for something, you know.
So, that's one way. And there's some sense. It was a little bit of a translation. There's some sense in which that's not on the Fourth Amendment necessarily even a search, because it's minimally intrusive. It's not like something moving through your suitcases. It's just dogs sniffing that which is in plain, what do you say, view? Plain sniff. That which is in plain sniff. So if we were to plug in, we get a plain presence on the internet, it's pretty close to the backbone. It's quite possible that a bunch of packets will come in going laterally from one place to the other to which we might have access. Is that within plain sniff, or would the FBI never have an interest in simply popping down somewhere on one of the backbones of the net and just watching the packets go by and seeing if there's any interest?
Well, firstly, in this preliminary matter, that would require a tremendous computer power. If you go up on the backbone.
Because it's quite a fire hydrant of stuff.
It's a huge volume of information coming through.
It would no faster than the computers that are running the backbone, though.
Right.
So those computers exist.
It would require an infrastructure for processing in place parallel to the backbone. The FBI does not have those resources. It is not seeking those resources. And part of that is when you think about it, let's just take the simple example of email. You send an email, it's chopped into 1,000 packets, and the packets are scattered over the internet. Let's say the word heroin is in the 1,000th packet. So this is a simplistic model.
I've got to argue with you. First of all, typical email message is 5 to 10,000 bytes, so it's going to be about 10 packets, and each of those packets usually travels along the same time. I know this because I run an internet service provider, and I'm actually working at a company that's developing wiretap software, so I'm really up on that.
Yeah,
the reality is, the same reason why digital telephony is not doing well, you cannot predict for sure the route which the packets will go. Right? So if you had a problem, if it is the predictability issue of whether or not you inform with your first packet or your last packet, make it difficult to discern the relevance of the recovery of the term bomb. This is your last packet. Yes, you may have the headers, you can go back and now demand with appropriate process the completed email. Filter out, well, was it the fire department reporting that they responded to a bomb? Or was it someone talking about making a bomb?
So,
or was it somebody bombed out of school?
So let me ask you just a quick question.
So the same problems we have with Westlaw would be exponentially multiplied for the Bureau in terms of it trying to evaluate that data.
So let me ask you just a quick hypothetical question. Again, this is all being asked about. So he's making it, just making sure that heat is up a little bit.
No. Wait, there's no heat.
There is no heat. No, we know that.
Well,
have an absence of coal?
The problem is, in the construction, it was a steam valve that you could heat this, and the computer is trying to talk to the steam valve, and it's not there.
Is there anything you can do?
I'm trying to be foolish. I didn't design the building. Too little wires are talking to the wall.
Gotcha. Okay.
So we'll get this straightened out next day or two.
Thank you.
All right?
Thanks very much.
And I apologize for anything.
We welcome. Yes. You're busy. Thank you.
Thank you.
we should note that I've been told by. Purposes. And, they monitor from time to time.
Well, what friends?
I'm less interested, actually.
I don't know that to be true.
It's not for title phrase, it's for other.
You know, actually, but I just thought, because we had this discussion when we were at Privacy in the United States. Depending on where it is you exactly. And depending upon whether or not your communications are traveling to another country. I mean, our laws only affect intercepting here in the United States.
Right.
You know, and so if you're in Europe and you're unfortunate enough to have that your packet travel through the People's Republic of China, even though maybe from some embassy in Europe to directly to Washington, D.C., you have to work on the assumption that those packets are in fact being intercepted.
You always have to work on that assumption on the internet, and this is why whenever I pick up my email from anywhere in the world, whether it's my office or while I'm traveling, the first thing I do is I bring up an encryption program, which creates a encrypted tunnel between me and the email server. And so there's absolutely no way for anybody monitoring the link at any of those points to get my email.
Okay, a little ahead of ourselves. We haven't talked about Quantum yet.
But we should talk about it.
We should. I agree. The one thing I want to ask you, before we talk about Quantum, because Carnivore is quite specifically pitched as, we have a suspect in mind, and the whole point is to figure out packets, and the only certain kinds of packets coming from that suspect, and making sure that the rest of the dross is not taken up by the filter. I just want to ask a hypothetical about kind of inverse Carnivore. If a gearhead in your office came to you and said, "Eureka, we have a new discovery. If you like, we now have the ability to go on to an interesting point of presence on the net near the backbone, watch packets going by, and certain files that have been adjudicated by a court in actual cases to be child pornography have certain signatures.
Right.
Those packets look a certain way. And we can just sit on the pipe and wait for those packets to go by. And when they do, we will figure out who's sending them to whom, and we can initiate an investigation for the interstate transportation of child pornography on the basis of that. In other words, it's a form of fishing expedition designed to catch a particular kind of fish.
And let's say it never has a false positive.
Right.
It never
has a distinct unique signature. What would your reaction be to your head offering this technology?
I would isolate them as quickly as possible. Let me say, I guess that's not too unlike in an electronic world, the idea of letting the dog loose.
Right.
Because the idea is, the traditional theory of the dog is not actually intruding. He's waving the air, and he's just out there. And dog cases have been suppressed for the dog to jump on the suitcases because it pushes the air out of the suitcase. So again, there's kind of a fight about where the air is going to come.
They're very safe in your suitcase.
But you could make that analogy, that scenario. Of course, there is currently a conflict amongst the circuits that believe that in some dogs and cases you have to have at least some reasonable objective suspicion to initiate the search. Currently, it's our philosophy that the verdict content track, aside from transaction to the phone, email, or the IP address of computers, with regard to the monitoring of content traffic, we will require process of the electronic data expression. So even having a completely blind sniffer program which operates on the basis of signatures really would be irrelevant, because you would have to be measuring the content that it went through in order to recognize the signature.
Gotcha. So whether it apologizes to the dogs or to Amazon from the user checks of people going through toll booths,
right.
The answer is current policy at least says we're not interested in that kind of fishing expedition, fishing for content.
Well, both policy and our interpretation of that.
And I have to say that you're right, that that's likely to be the case for T3s. It is the case, though, that this technology to do the sniffing on the fly does exist. And within the next 5 years, it's going to be widespread on the internet, not to catch child pornography, but to catch copyright violations. And it's sort of going to be pushed on internet service providers, maybe by the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and maybe by when the ISPs are actually owned by all the content providers, which, you know, AOL, Time Warner, they're going to be looking for people sending down illegal content where it's not illegal criminal, but illegal civil, and actively looking for this sort of stuff, and, you know, violating lots of rights in the process.
You know, it makes an interesting point. I don't know if you do get a chance to take a look at CDT.org, which is the Center for Marketing Technology, which is very active in this area. My complaint about them, which is kind of ever so quickly sudden segue, is they support this opt-out policy, and I have said to them in kinder words with people around, you know, I can't listen to you about power, I can't listen to you about interpretation of that, but for as long as you continue to support opt-out rather than opt-in. I mean, if you're for privacy rights, why is it that I have to tell someone, don't let that run me? And the reality is, of course, they get money from the industry. They are funded from the industry. Right? So I've used more colorful terms to describe their status. But I think the point he makes is interesting. And we were recently at a seminar in which we were discussing what we now think to be the type of data that's collected by DoubleClick, that's collected by PeerW, that's collected by private concerns for commercial purposes. And we're reaching a point where the Bureau, it may very well be, both from a political, from a legal, and from a utility resource perspective, to merely subpoena those companies for their data, because they are collecting more data on you and I than the government would ever hope to or care to collect. I think the issue would not necessarily be packets being sniffed for child porn, and it may be packets being sniffed. I mean, the combination of packets with the technology, stereography, the ability to implant a unique identifier for copyrighted products into the image, you can with images, something moving very, very quickly. But the reality is, where we hear this discussion is in the context of tracking transactions. And who find what, and in what volume, and where from. It's all commercial. But because that doesn't capture the specter of Big Brother watching, that falls out of the discussion.
Well, let's push that a little bit and then go back to Harnivore. One of the real problems you mentioned earlier was webmail. And webmail is just this huge problem for law enforcement, because, like, you don't know where the messages are. But you could go to DoubleClick, and if you knew somebody's DoubleClick ID, all these webmail things are advertiser-supported. So DoubleClick, in their records, would have a list of every single webmail service that the suspect is using. What's really interesting is that in many of the cases, they'll actually know the webmail user ID as well, because a lot of the images that are served up, the user ID is sent by the webmail site to DoubleClick.
So my guess is about 45% of the people here understood this point. I want 100% to understand it, but it'll be more understandable if we first, at last, turn to carnivore. So why don't you tell us about the carnivore, and tell us about it in two ways. Way number one is sort of how the thing works, and when you'd be inclined to use it, or how often it's used. And the second way is, what has made this such a big deal? Why is, out of all the things that could somehow be in the Wall Street Journal, and News.com, and CDT could be panicking about, what has placed carnivore in front?
Well, maybe I think the second first, which is the name.
Was it originally called Mama?
No, it was an earlier product.
That's really screwed up on the name. And I'm told that you picked that name to basically get FBI agents in the field excited to use the product because most FBI agents are really technology averse.
No, no, it was that name I was told, and I wasn't on the selection committee. The Austin Council sent down new names for it that we've selected.
Selection committee.
Right. We were we're in favor of the new generation program being called the like Fuzzy Bunny or something.
Yeah. See here, folks.
The thought is you get a better response when you tell an ISP that you want to install some fuzzy bunny software than Carnivore. The name was selected because this particular software program had a neat filtering set which allowed, compared to earlier ones, allowed for but-not characteristics. You could define the set, and then you could adjust the set. So let's just take an example. Let's say you're monitoring my email, and it's for a national security investigation. I'm arguably a mole for abortion. Well, I'm from New Bedford, so I hate abortion. But let's say in the course of those communications, you realize that I get ESPN listserv every day. Well, you don't want to keep capturing ESPN listserv news email. And I also get fine laws tech news.
And the way I would normally do this is the way Simpson was suggesting. I just go to the email server and I get a copy created
right.
of all your mail as it comes in. It's BCC to me, and then I can read it in my letter.
That's right.
Okay. But I get a bunch of stuff that isn't relevant to the thing I'm looking for.
And some people get a lot of irrelevant stuff. No, it still falls within the ambit of the warrant. It is still communications with them. And it's not even that which would be minimized in the sense of, it wouldn't be minimized in a phone world. It's with a name that targets. All right? And so it really represents, for some of these targets, a huge overcollection. Carnivore was good because it allowed them to fine-tune to exclude that which they deemed was recurring and which was not relevant to folks in their investigation. And therefore, that the agent ultimately was going to figure out how all this data fit into their investigation had less of a review. And so in that sense, Carnivore got to the meat of the matter, as they thought. That's where the name came from.
It could have been Bone Crusher or something.
Right.
I heard that explanation, but the guy who told me that was a front story. And the real thing was that they were trying to get agents in the field.
So it's somewhat a collateral issue, but there might be a sense in which the name actually has contributed to the notoriety of the...
Yeah, I think so. When you think of Etherpeak, the commercial product you can buy, and we call it Etherpeak, would have been really offensive to people, because it doesn't imply some sense that you have approval for. It's kind of like they're peeking around.
The Solaris operating system ships with a program called Snoop, which is a packet sniffer.
So, the commercial names aren't good as offense, it's just that it's not the FBI using.
There's one called ZX Ray.
Tell us what this thing actually is. So we've had, I think, twice in this class a discussion or exposition of packet sniffing and the way the networks. This is a flavor of packet sniffing.
Yeah, it is exactly a packet sniffer. Nothing more than that.
So how
except it has unique filtration.
Well, actually, it's a packet sniffer and a TCP/IP session reconstructor. So it doesn't look at packets, it actually looks at streams.
That's correct. I'm not an engineer by training.
But instead of giving you the pieces, it presents you with a complete puzzle of a given.
No, it's a two-step process. Carnivore merely collects the data. It is that transfer it has to be recomposed with a different program. And in that sense, what unique about this is telephone interception is in fact actually real time. But the cards as a technology used for email or webmail or any internet surveillance is not real time. It's a two-step process.
Gotcha.
All right. But let me just say, Corner War was developed in large measure because there is such a wide variety of capabilities of internet service providers. Large internet service providers have had to address, you know, capturing instant messaging, capturing web email and reply. But small mom-and-pop operations, which are using lease lines and limited business application servers, are not in a position to do anything other than maybe replicate email. And in some instances, they don't have the staff or the knowledge to do that.
So this alludes to the web mail problem that Simpson was talking about, which is, it's one thing to just say if there's mail coming in through simple mail transfer protocol to a POP server or an SMTP server, and you can then copy it as it comes in. But if you're using web mail, like yourmail.com or Hotmail, you're just using the web. You're submitting forms and reading stuff on the web, even though what you're really doing is sending email. And this then is a way of being able to get at that email, even if the internet service provider doesn't have a ready copy command, like it would if it were a regular email server located at the ISP.
You know, let me just draw back to you, because I don't know if you have that person. There is a communication system for law enforcement. Very broadly speaking, was a statute passed a few years ago where they were reconfiguring telephone networks. There were networks that were being proposed that even if you had a lawful court order, you would not have been able to intercept a telephone call.
Well, that was the case with the cellular telephone system in New York City in the 1980s. The systems that were deployed had no provisions made for wiretapping. FBI came along and wanted to do wiretaps. The only place to do them was through technician ports. And the system had 8 technician ports. So there was this long list of people waiting for wiretaps on cell phones to be executed. That was the impetus for the Digital Telephony Act, which became CLIA.
Right, and it actually was, as I understand it, some rather horrific cases where people were murdered and otherwise. So tremendous things happened while a sitting court order had been approved waiting to be implemented because it was not technical access. So CLIA was passed, which in a nutshell says that the industry and law enforcement have to get together to agree to standards that will technically allow for the interception of communications. Now, bear in mind, the exception to CLIA was the internet. Carved out. The internet was exempted to the extent that it was then envisioned, was not then into telephony. There's a debate about the scope of CLIA as to internet telephony, but at the time, with regard to emailing, I think it was clearly admitted that they were exempt from CLIA. So that put the FBI in a unique position, because here it was, if it were a telephony world, in large measure, the telephone company would have had to created the network in such a way as to allow for deception. And providers had to have some capability. But the internet didn't have that requirement. And so to deal with the mom and pop ISPs, you had to come up with capability. You could say to the supervisor, to the attorney general, well, you know, this particular terrorist group is thinking about blowing up such and such buildings using an IT, and they don't have any. We're really sorry.
How many mom and pop ISPs are there?
I know that in the last report that the laboratory issued, they had dealt with about 30 ISPs that did not have capabilities for web email.
So the interesting point that you've made, you know, to me is pretty new, is that the large ISPs have already developed fairly sophisticated interception technology for dealing with email, instant messaging, and so forth. But if you're at a small ISP, like if you're John Gotti and you're using the small ISP instead of the big Earthlink ISP, they're kind of in over their heads, and so you're trying to help them out by saying, here is the box that will do the intercept for you.
This is community FBI.
I understand that. It's a good thing. The problem with Carnivore is, of course, that the sophisticated felon will be using encryption, and Carnivore is helpless against encryption.
Well, a sophisticated felon will be working off of a verbal code or a telephone as well. It should be difficult to understand.
Is there any other
that it's not an objection.
Before we get to the encryption problem, or encryption issue, but in our neutral political culture.
That has raised another issue with Carnivore as well, though. An ethics set up at the Electronic Privacy Information Center says that the description that FBI uses to say what Carnivore does, that when they've actually reviewed the documents that they've gotten under Freedom of Information Act requests, it appears that Carnivore does a lot more. It appears that it's recording a lot more information. And the other claim that's been made is that the actual thing that Carnivore is doing, the actual packet sniffing of everybody's traffic, and then discarding of everybody's traffic except for the suspect, that's actually illegal under the statutory authority that gives you the right to do wiretaps. That the statute doesn't allow you to look at everybody's traffic and then throw it away. The statute says you're not allowed to intercept people that you don't have an order for, and Carnivore is doing that, and that the law needs to be rewritten.
Okay.
And in 1968, Congress never meant to give the FBI the right to intercept everybody's phone call and then just throw most of it away.
So, one objection is one of statutory construction and isn't really being looked at when you listen momentarily, at least, but they sniffer to everything and then discard the chaff. You can imagine fixing that as problem there was with the appropriate legislative tweak. The other objection gets to the question that Allison asked, and which has been a little bit reiterated just now by Simpson, which is, it sounds like people say, how do we trust that the system is doing what you're saying it's doing? When you cart this thing in and plug it in and lights start flashing on the mini oven, couldn't anything just be happening? And what's the answer to that?
You're asking me.
Yeah.
I'll answer. First, let me just say the Epic report, as I read it, was referring to the distinction between when Carnivore is operating in the pen register as to when it's operating in full content.
The pen register would mean analogously when it's just the IP address. Emails from and to, or the IP address from and to on hits.
That's right. And so there's a debate about what should be collected when a Carnivore is in the pen register. What computer is communicating with what computer? Almost like what telephone number is dialing what telephone. Right? The traditional analysis. And all it gets currently is the IP address, but there's issues like, you know, the time lapse, the lifespan of the packet, that type of data that Epic takes issue with technical data relative to the transmission. And there's great debate about what should be collected under pen register offices.
And there is two modes, or modes would be reflected in the authorizing warrant. The warrant would say you can use Carnivore, but only for pen register like things.
No, it's actually the other way around. It would be that the court order would say a pen register for, let's just say, email, for the email address of so-and-so. And in that scenario, you would just get just the twos in the front and the date.
Of emails.
Of the emails. You wouldn't get the subject line, you wouldn't get the body of the email. But the other thing is you would get the transaction number, you would get the trace route, you would get these other things. Epic takes the position that those things are outside the scope of an analogy traditional pen register. That's more than you would get than a regular phone call. Alright? We have debates on that. Today, if I put a pen register, I may, depending on the system, get all the intermediate carriers. I may get that data. So there's a lot of discussion about these points. On the question of full content, all right, there's the argument, just so we understand, and I understand the debate is whether or not it's like a dog, because the traditional theory of dog sniff is that a dog only tells you whether something is there. It doesn't tell you or not.
If only the dog can talk.
Right.
The dog can't talk.
Can't.
The dog can just say, I'm really excited about what's inside the sack.
Right.
And then you open it and you see what it is.
Well, the dog, by training, says it's three, four circuits, will only tell you whether there's heroin there or not heroin there. But it won't tell you that there's dirty underwear. It won't tell you whatever else is in the package. It's either there or not there. And that's why the court says that it is minimally intrusive, because it only tells you about the criminality of certain classes of data.
Right. Right?
And it does it arguably without delay, depending on how it's deployed.
But that's why you don't even need the court order for this.
stuff.
That's right.
You have a court order, right?
Right.
Typically, Carnivore is used.
Only
exclusively Carnivore is used. Only when it's important.
The sole exception would be in a victim case where a victim is requesting Carnivore in their incoming email, but there would be consent.
Gotcha.
Just like in the case.
No, that's not the sole exception. It could also be used in the case of a internet service provider that was trying to deal with price.
In this case, it's the victim, perhaps.
Maybe.
It's actually not used in that. And
but
I don't know what I'm going to get about that. We're currently using it either in court order or consensual based scenarios with regard to the current policy with regard to use in service provider exception under 2511 is to take a once group of data per time complaint and then get a T3. We do not utilize it for service provider authority. So, but let me just say, there's a debate about this question of scope on part of our question. Fundamentally, it comes down to this question. First, and I think it's important for a lot of people to understand, when we come to a small ISP or any ISP that doesn't have capabilities for capturing web mail or doesn't have any capabilities, the primary objective is, first of all, ask them, what is the smallest pipe they can give us that will probably have the target, the person who's been identified in the order, have their data. Some instances they can narrow down to a point of presence using a dial system in a rural area, which is less than 20 feet. So we try to work with the ISP to find
that's amazing. I can't imagine an ISP that's profitable that would deploy a dial up in a rural area to serve 20 people.
The reality is the dial system. It may be 20 ATM machines on a particular dial.
But at least just as a technical explanation, realize what he's saying is network topology can differ from a place to another.
But the other thing
is there may be ways to sniff so that you place the sniff in a place where the extraneous network traffic is minimized. That's what he's talking about.
And it's in our interest to do that. And typically, the inquiry with regard to service provider with regard to the policy will be specific enough so that the agents, because they're aware that they will have to subsequently identify this in the final report to the court, can say that the best efforts have been made to put it on the smallest pipe possible that has the predictable data. But the next thing that happens is that data is replicated. This carbon does not sit in the middle of the stream. That pipe is replicated if you would a dead end at which the end carnivore says it is in receive mode only. All right. The Carnivore has a set template. You get into the whole issue of the seven layers of packets and all the different. But the reality of it is, let's assume in a simple case we're just emailing. And it's two messages. All right. All the packets come in. The reality is, as each packet enters into Carnivore, when its signature meets the same electronic signature using simple mail transfer protocol of Professor Zittrin, that packet is replicated. When it does not, the next packet overwrites the first packet. So there's a constant barrage of packets. And so they terminate in the sense that they're overwritten on each other, right? And Carnivore can only see, all right, the packet that meets the criteria authorized by the warrant. So on the one hand, you could say, this is where the debate breaks down. Ethics says, but aha, you're looking into that packet. And in determining that it's not Professor Zittrin's,
you examine it. But this that gets to the first objection, which I agree seems more how do you treat the law if in fact the law is even off on this point to cover this eventuality. It seems philosophically, functionally equivalent.
Trees falling in the forest.
Exactly. But the second objection, sort of Allison's question again, is one of agency and trust.
The rogue secret service problem.
Yes. How do we?
So
it? Because at least in the case of in the case of telephone monitoring, we have a third party, the phone company, and who knows whether they trust them. But in many instances, they are in a position that if something funky were going on, where the agents show up to set up the trap or the trace, and they want to listen to everybody in the town, not the person that the order says, the phone employees would see that and somehow sound the alarm. Here it's a little bit more of a black box, right? You reel in the computer, you thank them for letting us in the corner, and then hopefully you reel away.
Well, let me start by saying that the ISPs, for the most part, do not want this duty. It's one thing for having to have an administrator tell the computer to replicate somebody's email file. It's an entirely different thing to to work with FBI engineers and know, because you'll have to know, the targets and the type of traffic that you're seeking to monitor, because it may expose your employees and your corporation to serious risk.
Right, one of your employees sees something and then releases it.
Well, in terms of jeopardizing the investigation, yes, right. But the same token, if the group you're monitoring wanted to, they could very well blow up your building. If they knew that you were engaged in activity to assist in their investigation prosecution, or the employees themselves could become the targets with regard to AOL, just take them, for example, they're so large, it's clear they have to be engaged in a certain amount of assistance to large ones. They have security concerns that their enforcement compliance division will be the subject of influence to criminal elements.
This is why FOIA originally had provisions in it too, that the equipment had to have remote monitoring capabilities, and you had to be able to turn on that remote monitoring capabilities without the knowledge or assistance of the equipment owner.
And that was the request of the providers.
That was the provider.
They're delighted to see no evil or hear no evil, or see no good and hear no good. They're delighted to have a black box there just doing the same.
You get some of that part delighted, but the reality of it is, clearly in the Collegiate Eight, and as it's played out, providers, if take a majority view, it's clear that they do not want to be put in a position of people having knowledge of the implementation of these orders.
So, and what do we do about the rogue Secret Service agent problem?
Well, first we've got the answer on Carnivore has built into it. Well, first of all, it's a double-layer authentication system, but that's built into it an audit trail, right, from the moment of its initialization. And that audit trail runs continually. And the way it's deployed is a technician from the FBI headquarters, just a small group of technicians that are capable and have the training for this. There's an internal procedure beyond the court order, merely to get the software, which is the reason why it's not right here today, in demonstration. There's an internal procedure in terms of its release involving supervisors for its deployment. And a technician from the laboratory division would go to the ISP physically with it and would meet them, try to figure out the network pipeline and the like, and would deploy it at that time and would activate the software. All right? The software at that point will not be able to be altered without the audit trail demonstrated or without starting a new audit trail. So apparently, that audit trail is subsequently disclosable and discovered. All right, so the defense counsel ultimately will be able to, with his experts, examine is there something inky about the correlation between the audit trail and the data that was intercepted as memorialized in the audit trail and the filters that were set. And they'll be able to argue that the filters were too broad and narrow.
So this at least says that the component of the Secret Service agent rogue problem, that is, you have one agent disavowing superiors saying, hey, keep it limited, trying to just snoop, will get caught by the superiors.
They first have to have the authentication of the technician and of the supervisor, right, requiring both, which are changed very quickly.
Right.
Right? They have to have some knowledge of where a car was implemented into the network.
Right.
And they're typically not allowed to be present. The investigatory agent, the greatest risk for unauthorized activity tends to be from the investigator who's been too close to the investigation.
And the fact of the matter is there's so many other good tools available for doing this that if you're interested in doing an unauthorized internet wiretap, you just don't use this program, use another program.
So in that case, unless you're worried about not just a rogue agent, but a rogue agency, at which point it's hard to necessarily verify because you've got to take a leap of faith or not, what's Epic's best argument, as you see it, so said, that says there's a real problem here, or is it in fact just a tempest in a teapot?
Well, I'm putting you on the spot here because I don't really have a lot of problems with Carnivore. I think it's a fine product. I've kind of pissed at the history, the personal history between me and my company and the FBI because we were involved in this back in 98. We were hoping to sell them something. But I, overall, don't have a lot of issues with Carnivore as it's been presented. One of the questions is whether or not the product actually meets the goals or the specifications. There is a question as to whether or not the FBI should be engaged in developing software of this type or whether it's better done by the public. or by private companies.
And that purchase was on purchase.
There's questions about whether, if the government is going to develop this, then maybe the government should make the source code available so that it can be evaluated. And you laugh, but you know, if it's just doing what you say it does, then you should make the source code available.
Well, there are limitations even Karma. This has been discussed at length. And any type of sniffer program is relying to some extent on certain known variables, the use of certain protocols. And to the extent that you knew what Karma could see and could not see, it wouldn't be too difficult to determine, well, let's create a tunneling protocol that Karma won't see.
Well, I mean, that's just a fallacious argument, because if you're that sophisticated, you're just going to run a VPN client and you're going to encrypt all your traffic, and nobody at the ISP you're going into is going to see a word. I gave a talk about a week ago, and I said that it's so amazing. You know, I travel all over the world with my laptop, and I just have to find a phone line. And I connect the phone line to my laptop, I dial an 800 number, I run Secure Shell, or I bring up an SSL connection to my mail server, and in less than 4 minutes, I've downloaded 100 email messages and sent out 50. I disconnect and I walk away, and there's no trace of what I've done. And even if you look at the call logs, even if you look at you know, the video cameras in the building, everything was encrypted. There's no way for anybody to figure out what's going on unless they have access to the mail server. And this is not special Simpson technology. This is using Microsoft Outlook Express. It has encryption built into it.
This is assuming the integrity of the software that you do.
That's right.
Right.
And assuming the integrity of the software at the other end.
So this raises squarely then the encryption issue. The encryption issue is your building says Carnivore, like pretty much anything else that's going to surveil in the middle, relies on the data being relatively unprotected. I'm just happily typing along, I'm sending my email unencrypted through the wires, and anybody in the middle can hear it.
Or the lack of knowledge of the public private key.
Right.
If you're not using RSM.
Right. So
if you do it with Diffie-Hellman, which the software also supports, there is no public or private key. There's just an ephemeral key that's created for the transmission and destroyed.
Which we talked about in our last session. So, to what extent would the widespread use of encryption for email, for instant messenger, etc., make Carnivore a relatively toothless tool, and more generally create a serious problem for the practice of law enforcement wanting to quietly sit in the middle when authorized and listed communications that are electronic?
Well, there's no doubt that it will seriously complicate and compromise those investigations. I don't think we've ever been able to. The director testified repeatedly that a resolution has to be made with regard to problems of encryption. And we understand, as everyone else understands, that there really needs to be a national dialogue as to what will be allowed.
There was a national dialogue, and there was no domestic controls on cryptography was the result of that dialogue. We've been having that dialogue since the mid-1970s. It's over.
It's not over. It's over. The reality of it is that there are some countries that will not accept encrypted data into their public switch system. And so the marketplace, to some extent, is going to affect these questions. I mean, it's very clear that the pressure for greater encryption in order to create more reliability for commercial transactions. People are fearful of doing those. So there's financial pressure for commercialization of the internet. By the same token, you know, it was interesting. I was reading back on some of the debates not that long ago. We recall back when the satellite industry was looking to encrypt HBO, and there was this great debate about the public airwaves being public property. If you don't encrypt it, the propagation of public airwaves was such that everyone doesn't enjoy using them. And then who is the encrypting that data? If they want to trace it along the facility, then they don't get out of doing everything. It's interesting that as much as we consider the internet a public place, it belongs to no one, everyone has it, it's all access. And we take an entirely alternate view to that than we did before to the establishment of the rating.
Well, regarding the HBO thing, 2 years after those discussions, we passed legislation in this country which made it illegal to listen to certain radio frequencies. And we had never done that before. There had always been this belief that you should be able, if the radio waves are passing through your body, you should be allowed to listen to them. But now it's illegal to listen to particular bands of the RF spectrum.
Cell phones.
Yeah, those frequencies.
Certain fillers and bullets can become content.
That's so never not, happened.
At least not to you. We have a panel today who prepared especially to engage on this issue. I just want to see if among the panelists today there are questions you want to ask our guests. Who's on the panel today who wants to ask a question? Yeah, anyone on the panel?
Yeah.
Hello.
Okay.
If Concord is so normal and okay and simple, then why were there 200 pages you wouldn't release to Epic, and half the pages you did release to Epic were blacked out? I think that's a description of words installed on the grassy knoll. The reality of it is that Cardboard was developed. I think that the deputy assistant director referenced that of the 25 times it was deployed, 16 times in the last year and a quarter or so that it's been since its development. Were for Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act surveillance. And the reality is that because the tool was designed for those capabilities, that there's going to be documentation relative to specific networks that the FBI repeatedly has to monitor. There's going to inevitably, for a national security tool, interception tool, there's going to be documentation that you cannot disclose because it's going to describe capabilities relative to specific networks.
Other questions for our panel?
Let me just say that the more important thing about that question is the court is going to have an in-camera examination with regard to this documentation. Right? Now, there's a challenge. It's not just that you have to like or love it, the FBI says. Right? There's going to have to be in the DC circuit, which deals with a lot of freedom of information. Tends to err quite literally with regard to this. We have a freedom of information section. They lose regularly with regard to disclosure information. But the data will be transferred to the court for that determination. So in the end, those 10 pages will be evaluated by the court. And the court will make a determination whether or not they agree with the FBI that would compromise the national security application protocol.
Yeah, question right here.
I was reading about some disappearing email technology, and it was saying it could be a threat to Cardboard. These people could start using it, criminals or whoever else could start using it to have their email disappear upon arrival, you know, after, I guess, a little bit after arrival. Does Cardboard see that, and do you see that as sort of a threat, or the fact that there's already encryption to recover that?
I don't know the specific. I'm sorry, your name was? You don't like me, okay. I don't know the particular technology you're referencing, although I find it hard to believe to the extent that it was upstream of the intended recipient, Carnival would capture.
Your button is
going to
turn off.
I didn't do it.
The disappearing email is really clever marketing, but it's really not very good technology.
Other questions?
Just correct it.
Yes.
I just have a question as to why you think the source code should be released on Cardboard. I mean, I just don't see the need for it from a practical sense. Just because I just don't think that many people are interested in it. So I'm trying to figure out like why you think it's necessary that the code be released on it.
Oh, cool. Well, the issue is not so that you can review it, but there are a whole bunch of academics who made their time doing this sort of stuff who'd like to take a look at it. And the FBI suggested having some sort of review, but only after these individuals signed secrecy agreements so that they wouldn't reveal anything that the FBI didn't want them to reveal. And traditionally, I mean, we've seen this before, like the last big case was when the RSA Laboratories came up with some secret algorithms called RC2 and RC4. And they said that, these algorithms were just fine, but if you wanted to review them, you had to have sign an NDA so that you wouldn't reveal it. And the Clipper algorithm, the National Security Agency kept saying that this is a fine encryption algorithm, but they wouldn't reveal it to anybody. There's this belief in computer security that the only really provably good systems are systems where you document how they're built, you document what they do, you release their source code, you let people analyze it, try to find holes, and if it's any good, it will withstand that kind of examination. And if it's not any good, it won't. So Carnivore might have undocumented features, it might have bugs, it might have significant failings that in the, you know, the tight-lipped environment that permeates the Hoover building, we'd never find out about. But if we revealed it to a large community, we'd be able to find that out.
Now, since you mentioned Clipper, we haven't really talked about it, and a whole bunch of things about it. Let me give my best 45-second version of Clipper, and I'm sure I can be authentic or corrected as need be. Clipper was an idea, to me, to my mind, designed around the fear that we wouldn't just end up encrypting our email. We ultimately were going to have secure phones as a routine thing. You could get them at Walmart. A little princess phone with a key in the middle. And when you called somebody else that had a similar princess phone on the other end, if you pushed your key, the phones would negotiate through public key encryption, a session key. And then anybody listening in the middle would just get garbage as they listened. But it's a principle, or you can imagine any communication that's digital, having encryption on both ends so that somebody in the middle can't hear it. There was a proposal floating around the government by Hook or by Crook to enable a Clipper chip. The Clipper chip was meant to be a chip that had some stuff under the hood. If you lifted the hood, the chip would fry. This page would self-destruct 30 seconds. And what was under that hood was so-called escrow key. And with that, somebody with a warrant, the idea was, could go in and listen in on the encrypted conversation, because they've got the extra sort of skeleton key to listen in as it takes place. Of course, to make that happen, you need the complicity of the technology to enable this extra key that the government either would hold, or that, in later versions of this, third parties would hold it, a bank could hold it, or a specially designed key vault could hold it. So the government really would have to present the warrant to the key vault, and the key vault would say, okay, that's a warrant, here's the key, and then you use the key to listen in on that particular princess phone's communication with another world, whatever it may be that's on either end. The idea at first was just simply required. If you are in the business of building encryption software, you've got to use Clipper. You've got to have it. Later versions said, well, maybe it should be, if you're in the business of having encryption software, you must have some form of key escrow, but we won't tell you what. And later versions even were, we won't require it, but the U.S. government, as a market player, will only purchase encryption software that has key escrow, and in this sense will encourage that to become the norm. And hey, if you're a company, wouldn't it be nice to have that skeleton key anyway? So that vis-a-vis your own employees who may leave or become forgetful, you can get into stuff that you need to without them having to remember their particular password, which in turn leads to their key. That was the idea. It ultimately has not gone anywhere, at least not yet. And at the same time, thousands of princess phones with that key in the middle are yet available at Walmart. I don't know if there's anything you really want to add to that.
That's fabulous.
I think I only would say that the process that was suggested, actually, at least supported the Department of Justice and the FBI, was actually that, assuming we made whatever the threshold showed, it would be probable cause to the magistrate, it would be the magistrate's responsibility to require the key and to transfer from law enforcement. So the law enforcement would not be able to establish a relationship with the escrow. It would be processed through the form.
Once you got to the escrow idea, which was not in the first implementation.
Let me just say a thing about, if I can double back again, the non-disclosure agreement is on the Department of Justice website. And if you take a look at it, it is, in fact, Illinois Institute of Technology has been selected as the institute to review Carnivore. They recently got the traction of Wall Street Journal because they have other government contracts. I'm sure MIT doesn't have other government contracts, so that would have been
not.
But says that you shall not disclose except to the FBI or the Department of Justice, or as ordered by a court. Right? So it's not quite like you can't disclose it unless the FBI tells you you can, as was recited. It's like you have to tell everything to the Attorney General and to the Deputy Attorney General, and with that goes her chain of command, the President, the Vice President. So we deal. The FBI is not an authority unto itself, and the non-disclosure agreement is designed to protect the national security application of Carter War, and still allow for a scientific review.
Matt, do you have questions?
Yeah, I was just going to ask you to describe in a little more, Mr. Mott, describe in a little more detail the audits, the audit file procedures, and who actually would monitor this, if anybody, and how the Defense Counsel would get a copy of this. Just the technologies and the procedures behind that.
It's just a running log. Every time Foreign War identified a packet, from the moment it was started up, it would be initiated. I think there is some initial data or technician who authorizes it. It sets all of the parameters. If it's a simple mail case report called intercept, it would identify whatever the settings were for its monitoring. And then it would be a running log of when data was intercepted. And together with the bin, you know, the receptacle for wherever that data is being stored, it would shoot, because they're both working on the same internal clock, it'll be syncopated and you'd be able to identify the exact data that came in relative to the log, depending on what filters. It would be, so in that sense, a defense attorney can request under a motion discovery or a motion to suppress or demand the court examine it with their own experts to determine whether the filters were adjusted or reset.
Is that log digitally signed in any way, or written to Raglan's media, or word drives, or anything?
I'd have to defer to Lester. I believe that they are currently doing write-only CDs. So the bird.
And the Carnivore has a little CD-ROM burner in it. And
But I think it has, depending on the application, where they're sitting, I don't believe that the peripheral is specifically set. Let me say, you know, there's a lot of talk about the black box. It basically sits on the PC. So.
Yeah, it's a PC. It's a transportable
PC. Have you had some experience with forged logs?
Oh, yeah, I've had experience with forged logs. I was an expert witness in a case in Utah where a employee at an internet service provider was fired. And, you know, he was having a fight with the other people there. And then a few weeks later, there was a legend break in at the ISP. And they ended up arresting the former employee. And this went to court. And I was, you know, for the defense. And we experienced how hard it is to get information out of the prosecution. But the really interesting thing was that a bunch of the log files had been modified, and we were able to show that in court. And we were also able to show that some of them had been fraudulently modified. And the jury found the defendant innocent. So that was like a good triumph of the American judicial system. But it taught me that it's really important that you have protections on log files and stuff, and that a lot of times prosecutions will just trust the digital evidence as being always correct. In this case, the digital evidence all came from the ISP, and the government really didn't even do its own investigation. They just took the word of the alleged victims of everything that had happened without realizing that they had an axe to grind with the former employee.
I guess I'm left with the question. Is it better that the government controls the surveillance or the ISP?
That's a great question.
Let me offer a few words to sort of
tie I don't think that
together.
Everything. Just give me a second. I think that all of our notions of surveillance are in for a dramatic change in the next few years. I think that the government as a surveillance entity is just hopelessly lost. And at the same time, I feel that private industry is going to be doing a massive amount of surveillance against all individuals, whether they're suspicion or not. And just as the FBI, and you talked about this earlier, just as the FBI now has an extensive relationship with Equifax and Experian and all the credit reporting agencies, I think that the government's going to go to private companies to do its surveillance for it. And that surveillance is going to be conducted just as the normal course of operations for doing copyright enforcement and marketing and stuff like that.
So we have just 1 minute left. Backlog is 10 minutes past. Let me offer just a few words to pull together some of the threads that we're talking about here. It may be useful to think of this in terms of the Orange Law, which may confuse Simpson Gregg, but as you recall, the Orange Law is the range of the possible, bracketed by technology. I don't think the Orange Law in this domain has moved a whole lot yet. The internet is still growing, and it's becoming, quite integrated with our lives. But the princess phones haven't arrived at Walmart yet. And as a result, the real sharp edge of the dagger that threatens a large swath of the way that state and federal law enforcement and federal surveillance, foreign intelligence gathering, whether the countries against us against other countries, has not yet been really put to it yet. Most criminals still remain dumb and don't bother to use the PGP tools that are out there. And as a result, you can pretty much approximate. You saw by way of analogy the way that they're trying to approximate the detente that was reached with telephones and pen registers, which literally is a detente that goes to the time of pens tapping on papers. And that law is about to move. And the fascinating thing, this is the Janus Technologies point, is that we can see that law going in either direction. It could go towards far more surveillance, whether from public or private sources, because we can imagine those herds of dogs running around sniffing everything, much cheaper to maintain than real dogs. They could be just looking for digitally signed copyrighted material or child pornography or what have you. And on the other end of things, you imagine complete strong encryption, so that routinely, even if you just send an instant message hello to somebody, it's encrypted so tight, the FBI or the National Security Agency would have a very hard time going to the trouble of decrypting. And it's the battles then over infrastructure, over the kinds of Kalea-like acts, communication systems, law enforcement stuff, that may well, among other factors, influence which way the law is going to move. So I agree that EPIC and the FBI and others kind of exhausted their public conversation from round one that was mostly surrounding Clipper. But round two is yet to come, and I think will be far more strongly fought because more will be seen to be at stake, including the meat and potatoes of the way that we gather information in our society. So with that, please join me in thanking our guests. Yeah.